Welcome back to the Deep Dive. It is Thursday, February 19th, 2026. And if you're a gamer, or, you know, if you just follow the entertainment industry at all, you know we are standing in the middle of a torrential downpour right now.
So it really is a storm, isn't it? The good kind of storm.
The kind where you stay inside and don't see the sun for 3 days?
Exactly.
But it's also chaotic. We're seeing a level of congestion in the release schedule for Q1 that is, frankly, it's unprecedented. It feels like every publisher just decided to drop their blockbuster at the exact same time.
Well, it's strategic.
Why now, though? Why February?
It's what I call strategic congestion. That's the key phrase. If you look at the broader landscape for 2026, everyone, and I mean every major publisher, from Ubisoft to Sega, is absolutely terrified of the back half of the year.
Because of the Rockstar behemoth.
Right. We all know it's coming. There's an open world game from Rockstar releasing later this year that is just expected to suck all the oxygen out of the room.
It's like releasing a movie on the same weekend as Avengers. Endgame. You just don't do it.
You don't. Mm. Though the logic is, you get your game out now, you make your money in Q1, Q2, and then you go hide in a bunker when Rockstar launches.
So they're scrambling, they're trying to squeeze their biggest titles into this, what they see as a safe 6-month radius.
Precisely. They need to secure player time and, you know, wallet share before that black hole opens up in November.
Which means for us, February has been an absolute gauntlet. But here's the mission for today's deep dive. We're not just going to talk about trailers or vibes.
No, we need to go deeper.
We're looking at hard data. We've got the telemetry, we've got results from the Tekken Game hardware labs, and we have the raw player data to figure out who is actually surviving this crowded month.
We have to look at retention. What is actually sticking with players once the marketing budget runs out?
So we're covering three absolute heavy hitters that just launched. Resident Evil, Requiem, the incredibly controversial Far Cry 7, Polaris, and the redemption story of Yakuza Kiwami 3.
Plus, we have to talk about the massive event happening literally tomorrow.
The one everyone has been waiting 7 years for.
Oh, yeah. You'll get there. But let's start with the masterclass. Let's talk Resident Evil. Requiem.
This is such a fascinating case study in brand management. You have to look at the context here. Capcom has been on a winning streak for, what, the better part of a decade now?
A long time.
But leading up to Requiem, there was this growing criticism. You saw it on the forums, on social media, that maybe they were drifting again.
Drifting back into the Hollywood action territory, right?
Yeah.
I remember people worrying it was going to be another boulder-punching fest like Resident Evil 5.
Exactly. The fear was that the franchise was losing its horror roots to go chase the action crowd. And Requiem is, well, it's Capcom's brutal, unapologetic response to that criticism.
It certainly seems that way.
They haven't just made a horror game. They've tried to perfect the technology behind horror.
And speaking of technology, let's dig into the visuals. This is the debut of RE Engine 2.0. The screenshots look incredible, but is it just high-res textures? What's actually going on under the hood? It's a pretty significant architectural shift. They've implemented this new micro-polygon streaming technology.
Okay, stop there. Micro-polygon. That sounds like a marketing buzzword. What does that actually mean for me sitting on my couch playing the game?
Think of it like this. In older games, an object, say a statue, is made of a set number of polygons. You get really close to it, you can see the sharp edges. It looks blocky.
Right. It looks video gamey.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Micropolygon tech, which is similar to what Unreal Engine 5 does with Nanite, lets the game import cinema quality 3D assets directly. There are millions of tiny polygons. You can put your face right up to a wall and see the individual grit in the concrete. There's no texture pop in.
So the detail is just there. It's not loading in as you get closer.
It's effectively infinite. But they're using this for something really specific in Requiem, the procedural gore system.
Yes. And this is where the tech meets the stomach.
It is.
I have to ask, is this just gross for the sake of being gross? Or does it actually add to the gameplay?
It's incredibly visceral. But it serves a purpose. It's not just shoot zombie, head pops like a watermelon. The system calculates ballistic trauma in real time based on physics.
So what does that mean?
We're talking about blowing away specific layers of skin, then muscle, then bone. And it all depends on the caliber of your weapon and the exact angle of the shot.
Wow. That sounds horrifyingly detailed.
It is. But from a design perspective, it creates feedback. You know exactly how much damage you've done just by looking at the enemy. Graze a shoulder, you see the muscle tear. Hit center mass with a shotgun, you see the cavity.
It grounds the horror in a kind of reality, which makes it scarier than just a health bar going down.
Infinitely scarier.
But usually when we hear about that level of detail photorealism, physics-based gore, we assume it's going to melt your computer. I'm assuming this requires a NASA supercomputer.
And that's the surprise. The lab tests from Teking Game are showing this engine is incredibly efficient. On mid-range hardware, and we're talking an RTX 4060 here, a very standard card.
A 4060.
The game is locking to 60 frames per second at 1440p.
Is that native, or are they leaning on some AI upscaling?
That is, with DLSS 3.5 enabled.
Okay, for the uninitiated, let's just clarify what DLSS 3.5 is doing there.
Right, so basically the graphics card renders the game at a slightly lower resolution to save power, and then it uses AI to reconstruct the image to look like it's high resolution.
It's AI guessing what the pixel should look like.
And it's gotten so good you can't really tell the difference. Capcom has optimized this perfectly. They haven't brute-forced the graphics, they've smart-forced them.
Which brings us to the actual game. Because pretty graphics don't matter if the game isn't scary. And they took a massive risk here, pairing up Jill Valentine and Leon S. Kennedy.
On paper, that sounds like a disaster for horror. Two super cops teaming up.
Right. That's usually the recipe for explosions, high fives, and corny one-liners. If you have the two most capable characters, how do you make the player feel vulnerable?
You do it through mechanics. The directorial approach is completely grounded. It's not an action shooter. They return to the 1996 philosophy of scarcity. But the key mechanic, and this is brilliant, is the inventory system.
Oh, the shared inventory. I've heard people raging about this.
It's strictly shared and persistently scarce. You're alternating between playing as Jill and Leon, but the item box is linked. The resources don't magically multiply.
Wait, so if I'm playing as Leon and I decide to go Rambo and use up all the shotgun shells, and then the game switches me to Jill?
Jill opens her inventory and finds empty chambers. She's defenseless because of choices you made an hour ago as a different character.
Oh, I love that. That creates such a unique layer of tension. You're not just managing your own survival, you're managing the future survival of your partner.
Exactly. It forces you to be altruistic in a single-player game. And that's why the critical reception is sitting at a 92 aggregate score. It's not just nostalgic, it's that oppressive atmosphere. It's a love letter to survival horror that actually evolves the genre.
So, Capcom wins on polish and atmosphere. But let's pivot to a company that decided to blow up their own formula. Ubisoft Montreal and Far Cry 7, Polaris.
This is the radical pivot, and honestly, they had to do it.
For years, we've made jokes about the Ubisoft formula. Climb the tower, reveal the map, clear the markers.
It's the fast food of gaming. Comforting, but repetitive. It was becoming a symbol of franchise fatigue. Sales were dipping because people knew exactly what they were buying.
So Far Cry 7 drops us in Alaska, a freezing, lethal wilderness, and they give us a 72-hour in-game timer to rescue the protagonist's family. But the thing that really shocked people, the thing causing all the noise, is the UI, or the lack of it.
The HUD removal.
Yeah.
Specifically, the death of the digital minimap.
It's gone. A AAA open-world shooter in 2026 with no magical GPS in the corner of the screen.
It is a shocking move for a mainstream title. I mean, think about how conditioned we are. We don't look at the world. We look at the little dotted line on a map.
They took away the crutch.
Completely. You have to use a physical magnetic compass. You have to pull up a topographical paper map that doesn't show your exact "you are here" dot. You have to actually look at the mountains and identify landmarks.
And this has, let's say, split the room.
Split is putting it mildly. The reception is incredibly polarized. On one side, you have the hardcore immersion enthusiasts. They love the vulnerability. They love the terror of getting lost in a blizzard while you're suffering from hypothermia.
They're calling it the most intense experience of the year.
Right. But then you look at the Steam reviews.
And it's a bloodbath.
The casual player base is revolting. They're review bombing it. The common complaints are that it's exhausting, stressful, and overly punishing. I saw one review that said, "I play games to relax, not to learn how to navigate by the stars."
People miss their dopamine loops. They want the check mark.
They do. But here's the fascinating twist. This controversy. It's arguably the best thing that could have happened to the franchise.
How so?
The sales data shows that being controversial has put Far Cry back in the cultural zeitgeist. People are buying it just to see if they can survive it. It's become a challenge. Can you beat the Alaska map?
But survival in Far Cry 7 isn't just about the map. It's also about your hardware. We have to talk about the volumetric snow because this game is bringing PCs to their knees.
Yes. The physics simulation. It is beautiful, but it comes at a severe cost.
What's actually happening there? Because usually snow is just a texture. Why is this different?
In most games, snow is just a painting on the ground. In Polaris, the snow is a physical volume. It deforms when you walk, it piles up, it melts. The taking game analysis shows that this game is heavily CPU-bound.
Wait, CPU-bound? Isn't snow just graphics? I thought that was the graphics card's job.
That's a common misconception. The graphics card paints the picture, but the CPU is the traffic cop that calculates the physics. It has to track thousands of individual snow particles, how they displace when a truck drives through them, and handle the AI navigating that terrain.
So if your traffic cop is slow, the whole intersection jams up.
Exactly. You can have a $2,000 graphics card, but if your processor is older, you are going to suffer. If you're running anything older than an Intel Core i5 13th Gen or an AMD Ryzen 5 7000 series, you are going to see severe micro stutters.
Especially in populated areas, I'm guessing?
Especially.
That's a pretty strict hardware floor. What's the solution for people who don't want to buy a new CPU today?
The expert advice here is to use frame generation.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you don't usually like it because of the input lag, you kind of need it here. It helps mask those drops when the CPU chokes.
Okay, so Far Cry is the bold, messy, hardware-intensive gamble. Now let's talk about a victory that's a little smoother. Yakuza Kiwami 3.
The Redemption Arc.
This is the remake of Yakuza 3 from, what, 2009? And for a long time, that game was the black sheep of the series, right?
It was notoriously difficult for modern fans to get into. The community affectionately, or maybe not so affectionately, called it Blackuza.
Because the enemies would just stand there and block everything.
Constantly. The AI was programmed to be incredibly defensive. You'd throw a combo, they'd block it, and the fight would just grind to a halt. It felt so stiff compared to the modern games.
Enter Kiwami 3. And the Dragon Engine. How much of a difference does it actually make?
It's night and day. The seamless nature of this engine cannot be overstated. We're talking about sprinting down the streets of Kamurocho, bumping into people, and transitioning directly into a brawl inside a convenience store with zero loading screens.
That flow is so important for a brawler. You don't want a loading bar every time you punch someone.
Completely. And the combat overhaul Kiryu's moveset has been reprogrammed from the ground up. It's physics-based now. When you hit someone, they react with ragdoll physics instead of some canned animation.
I saw a clip of someone smashing a neon sign over a thug's head in Okinawa. The way the glass shattered and the enemy just crumpled. It looked so satisfying.
It's visceral. But while the game is great, the business model is what I find fascinating here. This isn't just a remake. It's a strategy.
You're talking about the Game Pass launch.
Right. Sega made a very specific move. Day one launch on Xbox Game Pass.
Did it work, or did it just cannibalize their sales?
It smashed records. Within 48 hours, Kiwami 3 broke the all-time concurrent player record for the franchise on PC.
That's massive. But how do they make money if everyone is playing it for free on a subscription?
Think of it as a funnel. The Yakuza series has a massive backlog, 0, Kiwami 1, Kiwami 2, 4 through 8.
Mm-hmm.
By putting Kiwami 3 on Game Pass, they lower the barrier of entry.
So people who are afraid to try Blakuza give it a shot because it costs them nothing extra.
And once they're hooked on the soap opera story, they go back and buy the other games. Or they buy the cosmetic DLCs. It's the first is free model.
A textbook example of how to use a subscription service to grow a legacy brand.
They aren't just selling a game. They're selling an ecosystem.
So we have a horror masterpiece, a polarizing survival experiment, and a business model triumph. But we have to shift gears because all that data, all those benchmarks, you can basically set them aside for what's happening tomorrow.
Friday, February 20th, 2026.
The day the internet breaks. Hollow Knight. Silksong is finally arriving.
It's almost hard to believe, isn't it?
Yeah.
I feel like I've been waiting for this game since I was a different person.
It really is. We're talking a 7-year... Wait. The silence from Team Cherry became a global meme. Clown makeup, the whole nine yards.
Yeah.
But to understand why this matters, you have to remember 2017... The original Hollow Knight wasn't just a good indie game.
No, it redefined the Metroidvania genre. The interconnected world, the hand-drawn art, the precision of the combat. It set a bar that, frankly, very few AAA studios have ever touched. And it was made by, what, three people?
And now we get Silksong. But we're not playing as the Knight, we're playing as Hornet. How does that change the feel of the game?
It changes everything mechanically. Based on the preview builds, Hornet is significantly faster. The Knight was grounded. Hornet is an aerial acrobat. She uses silk grappling to zip across the screen. She has these fluid needle strikes. Mm. It's a much more aggressive vertical play style.
And what about the scope? Is this another 20-hour adventure?
Oh, much bigger. The Kingdom of Farloom is reported to be over twice the size of Hallownest from the first game.
Twice the size? That's intimidating.
It's massive. over 150 new enemy types. This is not a small indie sequel. Analysts are already predicting this is going to compete directly with the biggest AAA titles for Game of the Year. It's sitting at the same table as Resident Evil and Rockstar.
Which means the launch servers are going to be absolutely hammered.
Oh, it's going to be a bottleneck. The Steam servers might actually melt.
So we have a tactical launch guide from the Taking Game War Room for you. I want to walk through this because I want to be playing, not waiting. What is step one?
Step one is obvious, but people forget it. Preload.
I'm looking at the store page now. The file size is surprisingly small, about 15 gigs.
That is correct. About 15 GB, which speaks to how optimized their compression is. But even though it's small, do not wait. The servers will throttle. Download the encrypted file now.
Okay, downloaded. Now, step two is for the impatient ones like me, the New Zealand protocol. Does this actually still work in 2026?
It does, surprisingly. Because of how time zones roll out digital launches, if you navigate to your system settings and change your region to New Zealand.
I just become a Kiwi for the day.
Exactly. And this will often unlock the game roughly 12 hours ahead of the Western Hemisphere launch. It's the oldest trick in the book, but it works.
And step three. This one seems a bit technical for a 2D game, but you say it's critical for PC players. Updating drivers.
Yes. Both NVIDIA and AMD are deploying specific game-ready drivers for Silksong's engine early tomorrow morning.
Why do I need a driver update for a hand-drawn 2D game? It's not like it has ray tracing.
It's about frame pacing. In a game this precise, where boss fights require pixel-perfect timing, you do not want micro stutters. If the game hangs for even a millisecond while you're trying to dodge, you die. These drivers are optimized to ensure the delivery of frames is perfectly smooth.
So get your drivers, move to New Zealand digitally, and get ready to sweat.
It's going to be a historic weekend.
So looking back at February, this storm we're in, who won the month based on the Tekken Game War Room consensus?
It's tough.
Yeah.
But if we break it down by category.
Best graphics and atmosphere.
Resident Evil. Requiem. Hands down, it's a masterclass in modern rendering. Sets a new standard for horror.
Boldest pivot.
Has to be Far Cry 7. Taking away the map was polarizing, maybe even arrogant, but it was necessary. It evolved the genre and got people talking.
And best value.
Yakuza Kiwami 3. Hundreds of hours of premium content for the cost of a Game Pass subscription. You just can't beat that math.
It really has been an incredible month, but I want to leave you with a thought. We've talked about Tapcom perfecting tech, Ubisoft taking design risks, Sega mastering the business model.
All massive multi-billion-dollar corporations with thousands of staff.
Exactly. But tomorrow, Silksong arrives, a game made by a tiny team, originally just three people, that rivals the quality, the scope, and the excitement of everything we just discussed.
And likely surpasses them in hype.
So it raises the question. In 2026, do we even need these massive publishers and their safe release windows anymore? Or has the power truly shifted to the creators, no matter how small, who simply take the time to make art?
That is the question of the year. And honestly, I think we know the
end. Something to mull over while you're preloading. Thanks for listening to The Deep Dive.
Scene Farloom.